Well, I hope that gospel text was clear for everyone. Jesus said, as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us. What does that mean? So that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may be completely one, become completely one. What does that mean? I am in them and them in me. And these words come at a point where this is part of the setting for what Jesus is doing. This is a prayer that Jesus has. And the setting is that Last Supper. So we're past Easter, but we're actually going back to Maundy Thursday, the Last Supper. Jesus has just washed his disciples' feet. And then he goes on to this long discourse that goes on for several chapters. It takes up like a fourth of the book of John, where Jesus, talks for about three chapters and then he prays for another chapter. And in that prayer, which is all of chapter 17, Jesus, first of all, prays for himself, then he prays for his disciples. And in the section that we're reading today, Jesus is praying for those who will become followers. So he's praying for those in the future who will become part of this thing, right? In some sense, he's praying for us. And throughout all of that discourse, he's used this weird language of, I am in the Father and the Father is in me. And so we want you to be in us, right? So abide in us. This language of abide. Jesus uses the image of a vine and a branches, the way that a vine and a branch are deeply connected. They're distinct from each other, and yet they're deeply connected. And the power and sap and a life force of one flows into the other, right? Jesus is using this kind of metaphor to talk about being in connection and being in relationship with God. And so, all theology, all of Christian theology starts with these weird texts that don't make sense, fundamentally, right? I mean, there's this thing here that says, I am in them and they are me and you are in us. And then people are reading it and they're saying, oh, what does that mean? And because there's a mystery there, we love to solve mysteries, and all Christian theology begins with trying to say, okay, let's explain that. Is Jesus saying something here about God? Is Jesus saying something here about the nature of God and who God is and what is our relationship with God? And it prompts, the church is trying to say, okay, Jesus says, I am in the Father and the Father is in me. And it's all about being one, and we're monotheists. We've believed in one God. We've come out of a Jewish tradition where we believe in one God, and all of a sudden, we've got the Father, the Creator, and then all of a sudden, Jesus is here on earth, and he starts saying things like, I am, in the book of John, all over and over and over again, which is the same thing when Moses was at that burning bush, and God was speaking to Moses, and Moses says, tell me your name. And God says, I am. I am that I am. That's the name of God. I am. And so in the book of John, all of a sudden, Jesus is saying, I am. I and the Father are one. I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. Like, what does that mean? Jesus says, I'm going to give you the Spirit. I'm going to breathe the Spirit upon you. And somehow the Spirit comes. And like, are these three things, or are these one thing? And for generation and generation and generation, for hundreds of years, those early Christian followers, those early followers of Jesus, and they're wrestling, well, what do we do with this? How do we make sense of this intellectually? And this is how, and there's disagreement, and some people believe some things, and some people believe other things, and it's political, and there's also faithfulness involved, and at the end of the day, they come up with the doctrine of the Trinity, right? As a way of explaining how God can be one, and yet, how do we account for the threeness, right? And so that's where Christians start doing this higher math that Christianity has, right? Where one equals three and three equals one. Right? We believe in lower math. One chair does not equal three chairs. Three chairs and one chair are, that's that's an irrationality we don't embrace. But saying that there's one God and yet three persons, that's an irrationality we do embrace. Right? And part of the reason why we embrace it is because there's this something about that paradox that preserves the sense of the mystery of God for us. It doesn't make sense. But we found that in some way it's the best way we can talk about something that is beyond our understanding. And so when God says, I am, and Jesus says, I am, you know, I am in them and you in me, part of the reason why that doesn't make sense is because it's like, oh, spatially, how does that work? How can three things be in one place? How can three bodies, like if we were talking about three human bodies, like they're bound by space and time. The physicality of them doesn't work to say that I am in them and they are in me. And so there's a lot of theologians who are coming along and saying, well, maybe we should give up trying to talk about God in terms of spatial categories because God isn't bound by space and time. Are there other metaphors that we have to explain how things can be separate and unique and yet be in communion and be in union? So there's a theologian named Jeremy Begbie who thought about music, right? What does it look like for music? Like if you play a note, I've done this before, but you play a note, right? This is a C, and I can add an E, and those two can coexist in the same space with each other. They're separate. C is different than E. But when they come together, they're a different thing, right? You can add a G on top of it. Three separate things, but one thing. All of a sudden, you have the Trinity right there, right? You can add another note. I don't know if I can make a good chord. That's adding the humans in it, right? I mean, that's right. But they all work, right? I mean, they all coexist. I mean, it doesn't quite work, but I'm sure if I was a good musician, I could come up with a different, right? Anyway. So Jesus says, Father, as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us. Right? May they be in us. You know, when those early, you know, Cappadocian theologians or theologians from Cappadocia, Greek fathers and mothers were talking about God, and they were reflecting deeply on these things, and they talked about if God is love, if God is relationality, what it means for God to be God is that God loves. And for love to happen, there needs to be an I and a thou. There needs to be two things. There needs to be, it's a relational thing between persons. That's what love is. You can love objects that don't love you back. You know, I can love pizza, but that's not the same thing as loving a human being who loves me back, right? And so if God is love, and there's this, God is loving God's self, there needs to be some sort of community. And so maybe there's a way in which what Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is trying to reveal or is trying to show us is there's a way in which one part of God is deeply in love with this other part of God, which is deeply in love with this other part of God. That the Father loves the Son, who loves the Spirit, who loves the Son, who loves the Father, who loves the Spirit. And there's this kind of outpouring of self within God's self and this flow of just delight, this flow of joy, this flow of love. Right, that is the very nature of God. It's this dynamic celebration of the other, of being, of love, of beauty, of goodness, of justice, right? The characteristics of who God is. That is the very nature of God. And if that's what God is, that somehow the divine is this is the structure of the divine. What we're talking about is the architecture of the divine, if you will. There's this threeness and oneness to it. This communion and unity and yet diversity in the midst of it. And this, you know, God is there in the midst of this perichoretic, which is the Greek word they use, perichoresis, this perichoretic giving of one to another and the celebration and this just delight in love. And God says, gosh, let there be something else for us to love. let there be something that's not God so that we can love that too. Let there be a creation. Let there be light. Let there be stars. Let there be planets. Let there be animals and creeping things. And let there be humans made in our image. And it is good. Let there be these things so that we can continue and broaden this celebration of love and delighting in the other. And let's bring this creation into our love. Let's bring this creation into the divine dance that we participate in one another. That right there is Trinitarian theology. Right? The heart, I think, of what Trinitarian theology at its best could be. It often hasn't been that. Often it's been a source of, you know, anathemas and heretics and fighting and, you know, all that. And so... that's rot in our Christian history. That's like that bad chord, you know, at some level. But Jesus, I mean, those theologians thought, well, that seems to make sense and that seems to be congruent with what Jesus is saying. I am in them and you in me so that the glory that you have given me, I've given to them the glory that you have given to me. What is glory? Glory has something to do with awe and beauty, and it's the very nature of God. The glory that you've given to me, I've given to them. I've invited them into glory. I've invited them to share in our glory. They're created in our image so that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may be completely one. So that the world may know that you have sent me and I have loved them and you have loved them even as you have loved me. The goal is love, right? The whole thing is like, this is the architecture of love. This is the way in which love is possible. It's this invitation into relationship and communion and the capacity to give and receive and be in that kind of relationship with each other. And what Christian theology is saying is that's part of who we are. We're created in the image of a Trinitarian God. We're created in the image of a loving God. We're created in the image of a God who gives and receives and delights in the goodness of the other. And that is somehow what Jesus is all about, right? Is that Jesus came to kind of invite us into that process. Curious what you're thinking as I talk about this. Where does this take you? Baffling, confusing, ridiculous? Yes, Diane. So what comes to mind is the instant love that happens between a mother and a brand new baby. Yeah, I think that's a great example, actually. There's a psychologist by the name of Jessica Benjamin who notices, like, newborn babies, they can't see very far, right? But they can see the distance. They can see whatever the distance is, like 18 inches or whatever, from the mother's breast basically up here. And there's something about the eye contact, right? So, I mean, they're physiologically, there's these, you know, what do they call them? Oxytocins or whatever, I don't even know what the name is, right? Whatever it is, those chemicals that get released in the brain that bond you to your baby. But there is this moment where the gaze of the mother and the mother of the child, and there's this moment where, and I've never done it because, I guess I did it at the other end, but I haven't done it as a mother, where the mother looks into the child's eyes and the child gazes back on the mother. And there's this intersubjectivity that happens. The mother delights in the child, and the child actually delights in the mother in return, and there's this reciprocity that's happening there, right? That does happen. That's part of our real human experience. And Jessica Benjamin, as a psychologist, is saying that is a profound moment in terms of that baby is being shaped. That love, that gaze, that intersubjectivity helps create us into being who we are. Yeah. And what's curious then, though, and so part of the whole notion of Trinity being one and three and three and one and this weird higher math that, you know, Christians engage in with that, is it's about unity and it's about diversity. And it's how do we hold those things in tension with each other? There's that moment where, I mean, the baby starts out as part of the mother's body, right? The baby is the mother's body in some real way. And then all of a sudden the baby is ejected and is not the mother's body, and there's wailing and gnashing of teeth that happens, right, on the baby's part at that moment, because that's a profound separation. You're cut off from unity and communion and you know, literally thrown out into the world, into your own, you know, separateness. And yet, you know, the more research they do in terms of babies and mothers, even though the baby physiologically is separate from the mother's body is still regulating the baby's body. The baby is still really dependent upon the mother's body for its own self-regulation. It does not have the capacity to do yet. So there's still, even though there's a physical separateness, there's still a deep interconnection between mother and child. And it still happens. And in that moment of intersubjectivity, where the two of them are one, or the two of them are delighting in the other, there is communion, right? There's unity that's happening, and yet they're also separate. And the two are held in tension. So that's part of this Christian, I mean, part of this one and three and three and one is the way Christian theology has of trying to navigate. What does it mean to be part of, in communion with God? What does it mean to be created in God's image? What does it mean for Jesus to say, I am in the Father and the Father is in me, and so you are us? What does it mean for us to be in God, to live and move and have our being in the very bosom of God, if you will? To use that metaphor. And yet also be separate. Christianity holds on to union. Like there is a unity, there's an intersubjectivity, there's a deep interconnection between all. And yet there's also separation, there's also diversity. Right? I am created in the image of God. God dwells in me, and yet I am not God. God is there and I am here. I mean, and yet God is here and in me, and there's a tension and there's a paradox between it. And this is something that distinguishes the Christian approach to kind of more Eastern approaches like Buddhism and Hinduism. No, the divine is all within. We are all have the divine within us. And our sense of separateness is in some sense an illusion. It's a cause of our pain. It's a cause of our frustration. And enlightenment entails kind of the understanding and recognition that we're all deeply interconnected and we're all deeply part of the same divine, you know, spark of the universe, which is good. Like I think Christianity also wants to hold on to that. That's part of what we want that's part of the unity. When Jesus says, I am the Father is in me and I am in the Father and you are in us, it's moving towards that deep interconnection, that deep sense. And yet, Christianity has also then held on. We want to hold on to that, but we also want to hold on to diversity. There's Father, Son, and Spirit. There's a diversity that's there. There's separation that allows for the possibility of love, that allows for the possibility of delight. And we hold the two in paradoxical tension. One equals three and three equals one, unity and diversity. I am in the image of God. God dwells in me, and yet I'm also not God. I am a creature. And I find that actually incredibly comforting, that I don't have to bear the burden of being God. Right? And in my relationship with others, it allows me to have that, I get to love you and to recognize that you too are in the image of God, to recognize our connection, to recognize our deep and profound intersubjectivity. And I also get to delight in your difference and how you're different than me. I also get to wrestle with how you're different than me and suffer with how you're different with me, right? But that's part of the human, that's part of our human being. So I'm going to ask again, where does this take you? What are you thinking? Wholeness, forgiveness, connectedness. How about others? Yeah, David.
I thought the musical analogy was
I think that's great. I think in that moment where God creates something other than God's self and God creates the creation to be in relationship with the creator, but there is an inherent tension that's set up because it also creates the possibility of discord. Which, you know, and that opens up the possibility for pain. That opens up the possibility for suffering. And there is discord, right? But fortunately, you know, you have a discordant chord, you can also resolve it into, you know, a chord. And that's part of the Christian narrative, is that actually God has been working and trying to relieve the discord, undo the discord, and bring about, I mean, when we talk about salvation, when we talk about restoration, when we talk about transformation, that is the Christian hope. You know, that we can, it accounts for the reality of our lives. We have this longing to be one. We have this longing for community. We have this longing for love. We're created for that. And yet we experience the disjunction of what happens when love is imperfect, when we're not loved well, where there's disappointment, where there's selfishness, right? And the ache of that in our lives. That's real too. And how do we, that's part of our journey as humans, how do we live with that? That moment where, you know, that deep inner subjectivity of the mother and the baby, right? That's there, that's real. And, you know, 12 hours later, the baby's crying and won't go to sleep and mom's tired and she's irritated and, you know, and there's not that profound inner subjectivity going on there. She's like, shut up, let's go to bed, right? It's part of the reality of things. Anybody else? Where does this take you?
I'm wondering about that profound connection between mother and child and how that relates or what the similarities are with father and child, because there's something profound there too, and I'm thinking about the differences between the two connections.
Thank you. Because it is there too for the dad, right? It is there too for dad. And although dad's not as strong, you know, I mean, the baby really was part of mom's body, right? The baby never really, I mean, the baby has dad's DNA, but it's never there. Dad has to deal with more of the separateness. Mom gets to deal with more of the bondedness, actually. And part of being human is learning how to deal with both. Is learning how to deal with intimacy and connection and union, but it's also learning how to differentiate and become other and separate. And we exist between those two poles, right? Baby is part of mom's body and then is ejected to mom's body and then is doing this intersubjective thing, but there's a point where the baby starts learning to crawl and the baby crawls away from mom. The baby moves away from mom. And it's not sure, oh, is this okay? And she looks back and then she starts crawling back to mom because she wants the unity. But then she needs the separateness again, right? And often the role of dads in that is to help invite the baby into their differentiation, into the otherness. I mean, I think both moms and dads do that. I think both moms and dads have intimacy and differentiation, but there is a gift that dads bring too that I don't think moms do, right? Yeah, Shannon.
I was just thinking about when you were talking about moms helping regulate the babies. I see that in a larger scale where, like within the classroom, the adult and also the other children have a profound effect on the atmosphere. If one child is feeling dysregulated, it can pull the whole group off, and it's up to that adult, whoever is in charge, and also the other students in the classroom to bring that child back into self-regulation. So I think we have a profound impact,
yes,
on everybody that's in the room,
yes,
how we're feeling and how we present ourselves and how, whether we present a calm or we're irritated, that affects,
yes,
everybody. Like it just,
yeah. We're social animals, and, yeah, and our own emotional states, we're impacted by each other's. And they actually, in the 90s, they discovered what they called mirror neurons, that there are actually neurons in our brain that will mirror the emotional state of those around us and replicate that emotional state in our brains. So we actually, they've discovered the physiological substrate that accounts for Why, if somebody's anxious, they're going to make other people around them anxious. Or if somebody's calm, they're going to make other people around them calm. That's not some abstract, you know, disconnected thing. That's actually a reality that's happening in the physiology of our bodies. It's part of our, you know, our intersubjectivity and interconnectedness, right? Other thoughts? Sandy. To call to give ourselves over to something that's other than we are, bigger than we are, which is in some sense the call to give ourselves over to love and being loved, and to overcome our own tendency to want to you know, gosh, sometimes it's safe to feel like, oh, I can do it, or like, you know, I'm you know, I can make this happen, but to give ourselves over to that is part of the human dilemma. Yeah. All right. Feels like we should probably move on. Who knew that a conversation around Trinitarian theology could be so interesting, right? But that's what we did. We talked about the Trinity.